I work in and around Colombia. They're very gracious to invite me to come and give you a little talk on tolerance in Islam. Tolerance is a very important subject in regards to Islam. It's something that I think every Muslim should know something about. So I hope everybody will benefit from this lecture, be it Muslim or non-Muslim. We'll try to run through it. I think we're going to be a little bit late, but I'll try to run through. I have a bunch of slides, and so I might skip over a few here and there. But if I'm going too fast, if I'm talking too fast, if I'm not talking loud enough, then just let me know. It'll be a pleasure for me to repeat or to answer any of your questions concerning something you might be confused about. If you have comments or criticisms, I would appreciate it if you would try to keep them to the end, please. I thought it would be beneficial to start this lecture by talking about the evidence of civilization. People talking a lot these days about civilization and humanity, these big, big conceptual words. Now, one of the most important things we have to understand about civilization and humanity is that in the eyes of history at least, one of the greatest characteristics of any society or any society that deserves to be called a civilization or a humanistic society is the level of tolerance that they give to people with other ideas. And that's why, for example, the United States is held in highest peak in the world today because of the freedoms that it had provided in the Bill of Rights, for example, the amendments concerning the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion and the freedom of press and all these things. This is something which is very critical, and this is what gathers the high esteem of many nations around the world. And so, historians' glasses of tolerance when it comes to any society and any civilization. Next slide. I wanted to first bring up the misconceptions that I'm going to be addressing. This lecture is going to be basically addressing these main points. First of all, many people believe that Islam was spread by the sword, meaning a forced conversion. This is a complete inaccuracy, and we will discuss it in the slide. The second major misconception is that people believe Islam is synonymous with oppression, coercion, and denial of basic rights and freedom. Again, another complete fallacy, and we will try to address that in this lecture. The third major misconception is concerning that Islam is a religion of intolerance and extremism. And again, a major fallacy, and we'll try to address that as the time goes on. One of the things I'd like to clear up right now before we go any further is the common misconception that people have when trying to understand the religion of Islam, that they want to look at the Muslim world today. And what we need to understand very critically is that there is no country today which is in 100% applying the Islamic ideals. None. There is not one. Most of them, in fact, are completely devoid of Islam in their governments, and this is why it is not a good idea for you to say, well, let's look at, you know, country XYZ in the Muslim world, and, you know, they're not doing any of these things, so how can you say this and that? We're talking right now about the religion of Islam, what's in the book, what happened in history. This actually did happen, the things we're going to discuss. Give a lot of examples from the history of this religion, specifically the time of the Prophet ﷺ and the time of the companions that ruled this, the Islamic nation, but to try to look at the Muslim world today is a big mistake, and I would strongly recommend that you don't do that. Most, in fact, many Muslims are working hard and striving hard for change in the Muslim world today to try to go back to those precepts that Islam was founded upon. So, concerning the truth, I always think this is a very important thing. A lot of people want to jump to conclusions. They want to listen to one report in the news. They want to read one article in the newspaper. They want to listen to one person, so-called experts on Islam and things like that. I think it's critical to view this verse in the Quran where it says, O believing people, if a wicked person comes to you with any news, just determine the truth, unless the harm people unwittingly and afterwards become full of repentance what you have done. So it's important for us, if we want to understand any issue, okay, is to try to be very unbiased and objective when we come to it, try to look at all the aspects of it, and be very careful listening to those people who are known to be biased and wicked. Next slide, please. In the Quran, it is mentioned that all humanity is one great family. Okay? God says in chapter 49 of the Quran, verse 13, O humankind, we created you from a single pair of male and female and made you into nations and tribes that you might know each other, not that you may despise each other. But the most honored of you in the sight of God is the most righteous of you. And this is concerning the concept of equality of mankind in the eyes of Islam and the eyes of God, but with one distinguishing feature. The distinguishing feature in Islam is not your color. It's not if you're Arab or black or white or yellow or red, if you're from the moon, if you're from Mars. It has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with what language you speak. It has nothing to do, you know, with what educational level that you have. What it has to do with what is your character. How good of a prayer, how righteous are you? How God-fearing are you? This is the only differentiating factor in true Islam. Next slide, please. Also, we look to justice as a major facet of the religion. When God says in chapter 4 of the Quran, when you judge between people, judge with justice, how excellent is the teaching which God has given you. And the next slide further emphasizes this point with even your enemies. For God says in the Quran and Surah Al-Ma'idah, O believing people, stand up firmly for God as witnesses to fair dealing, and let not the hatred of others towards you make you swerve to wrong and to a departure from justice. Be just, that is next to righteousness or piety, and fear God, for God is well acquainted with all that you do. So, right now, if, for example, we look at the nation of Israel, for example, to take Israel for a moment, that is involved in a lot of practices which are deemed to be oppressive and wrong against Muslim people and Christians as well. Now, if you see a Jewish person, does that mean you're going to blame Israel or blame him for everything that Israel does? No. This is not how we practice Islam. This is not how we view people. View people as one person, as one individual, and we have to be just in anything. And we're going to show a lot of examples of this. We also see in the Quran the special bond between the Muslims and what is termed the people of the book, as in Kitab, which are the Jews and the Christians. And so God says, concerning them, concerning the Christians in specific, and nearest among them, in love to the believers, will you find those who say Christians. And what I didn't write was, because among them are people who are not arrogant. The Christian people have been known for a full history because of their monasticism to not be arrogant people. And so these people are consistent love to the believers, in this verse meaning the Muslims. Fine. Now, the last verse, or close to the last verse here we're going to talk about, is the unequivocal right to freedom of thought and religion in the Islamic state, or in the Islamic ideology, okay? And this is the clear verse, there is no compulsion in religion, truth stands out clear from error, okay? Which means that you cannot force someone to accept something, okay? If I come and I pick the, you know, this person here, I say, here, I'm going to introduce you to this concept. You like it or you don't like it? He says, I don't like it, okay. I introduced it to him. That's our responsibility as Muslims, is we give the message. That's all. We are not responsible for what anyone does. Someone wants to be, you know, take that message, apply it, not apply it, you know, criticize it, not criticize it, it's not our problem. What we need to do is, this is the responsibility of Islam, is to to preach the message, and that's it. We're not responsible for converting people. Okay, and we all know, every Muslim says you can't convert somebody. If you give the information, and sometimes you give it in the worst way, but God is the one that puts guidance in someone's heart. Not you. You can never do it. With a sword, with a book, with a baseball bat, with an electric chair, you can't do it. Okay? It has to be something in the person's heart. And that means you have to convince the person. And so this is why God always encourages the Muslims in the Quran to preach with fairness, to preach with good speed, to preach with patience. These are all the things we have to do. Also, in the Quran, God talks about protecting the houses of worship, and not just mosques. We're not talking about mosques here. But we're talking about all religious places of worship, specifically for the Muslims and the Christians. And so God says in the Quran, had not God checked one set of people by means of another, in other words, if God had not said one group of people to fight and defend against another group of people, you would surely have been seen the pulling down of monasteries, churches, synagogues, and also the mosques in which God's name is commemorated often. And so we are part of the religion of Islam. And you tell me now what other religion is out there defending the other, you know, places of worship. This is not something you will not find in history. And so we see also how to deal with interpersonal hostility. We're not talking about nation versus nation here. We're talking about group versus group. We're talking about one person versus another. Okay? And so if I harm Shaban here, how is he going to deal with me? He's not going to return it to me. He's not going to come back and abuse me for that. And God, because this is what God says. It says, repel evil with what is better. Then you might find that the one who hated you might become as close as your friend and your intimate friend. And no one will be granted such goodness except those who exercise patience and self-restraint, none but persons of the greatest fortune. Now, this is in interpersonal dealings. Again, you know, we see this from the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. People used to abuse him. They used to insult him. They used to put trash on his doorstep. And they used to try to throw thorns in his way when he was walking at night. And he did not go, and he did not tell the Muslim army to go and bring this person and slaughter him in front of the Eagle. No, he tolerated it with patience. And in fact, some of these same people that abused him, he would go and visit them when they were sick. This is how we deal with each other interpersonally. Now, when we're talking about nation versus nation, that's a different story. Because again, justice is critical in this time, and you cannot allow injustice to continue. But if you're going to be, you know, not such a nice person to me, alhamdulillah, we're going to tolerate that. We're going to show our patience. We're going to show our understanding. Next slide. And so I think the last verse here that I wanted to mention was the mission of the Messenger of God, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and God says concerning him, we have not sent you except as a mercy to all mankind. So this man, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, is a mercy to all mankind. In fact, I think this is not even a good translation because it's an alameen. An alameen means the universe, okay? It means everything. And so if a Muslim practices his religion as he should, then this should give mercy to the environment. It should be a mercy to the animals. It should be to Muslims. It should be a mercy to non-Muslims. Because if you're practicing your religion, you're going to be good to all those things I just described. And this is exactly what the Prophet commanded. Be good to the environment. Show the rights of people who are under you. Show the rights of people who are your enemies. Everybody's got rights, and we have to show them. And this is why Muhammad, even though some people are not going to believe in him, they're still going to feel the effect of the mercy that was sent with him by God. And we'll show this. So the next set of slides is concerning the concept of tolerance in history by the Muslims. And so there's a few slides, Islamic tolerance in history, and we start with the Prophet himself. The first phase of the Prophet, we have to understand that the Prophet was in Mecca for 13 years. Okay? 13 years. The message came down to him, and he started proclaiming it against the Meccans. And anyone who studies the lifetime of the Prophet knows that immediately what happened? They started fighting him, they started abusing him, they started torturing him and his followers, they even killed some of his followers. Fear is driven through them for this faith. One of the very famous stories is one of the black slaves, Bilal. He was thrown out in the middle of the desert with a big rock on his chest in the middle of the hot sun, the hot Arabian sun. He was frying out there, basically. They were baking out in the sun. And he continued to say, one, 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 meaning God is one, because they wanted to turn him away from that. And so this is what the Prophet faced in Mecca. He faced torture, and he faced persecution, he faced hostility. But after those 13 years, God commanded him to leave Mecca, that he had proclaimed the message there, go now to Medina and establish a Muslim state, establish a government based on the rules of Islam. So when he went to Medina, it happened that there was a great drought in Mecca, and the people were suffering from this drought. So this is one great opportunity for the Prophet, right? It's an opportunistic chance here. You can take them now. They're weak. You can go ahead and attack them and take the city. You can get back at all those people, right? That's what a lot of people want to do. Get revenge. But what did he do? He sent charity to the poor among the Meccans to help them. These are the same people that tortured him and his followers. Yet what did he return? He returned goodness to them. Again, this is part of the tolerance of Islam. Often in the people of Allah, there's a very nice hadith or a story which is related concerning the life of the Prophet and the people of Taif. Taif was a city that's to the north of Mecca. And Aisha, the wife of the Prophet reported, I asked the Prophet, have you ever experienced a day harder than the day of the Battle of Uhud? And he replied, indeed, I experienced them, these dangers, at the hands of your people. The hardest treatment I met from them was on the day of Aqaba when I went to one of them, one of the chiefs of Taif, with the purpose of inviting him to Islam, but he made no response to my call. So he departed with distress, and he did not recover until he arrived at this valley, Qanasad. There I raised my head and saw a cloud that cast its shadow over me. And when he looked into the shadow, he saw the angel Jibreel. And Jibreel sent the peace on him, and he said to him, indeed, God has heard what the people have said to you and the response they made to you. And he has sent you the angel in charge of the mountains. Taif being, you know, in a valley, okay, or close to a valley, mountains around it. So he sent the angel who was guarding these mountains, and the angel said to him, the angel of these mountains said, if you wish, O messenger of God, if you wish, I will bring these mountains together and destroy everything in between them. I will destroy the city for the treatment that they gave to you. Because he went there with a simple message, worship God alone. Worship God. He didn't want money from them. He wasn't asking them to buy him a Mercedes or a nice camel or a nice horse or a nice sword. No, he said, worship God alone. That's it. I don't want anything else from you except that you turn your worship to God. And what did they do? They rejected him. They rebuked him. On his way out, the people gathered in the city to throw garbage and rocks at him on his way out. So he came out bleeding, and he went into this valley, and he was so sad and hurt by what these people had done to him. And so he had a chance again here. He had a chance to destroy the people that hurt him. But what did he say? He said, no, I rather hope that God will raise from their descendants such people as will worship God the One and will not ascribe partners to him in worship. So he had the chance to hurt them, but he said, no, it's a good chance that, you know, in the future their children will worship God. So we don't want to destroy them because their goodness will come from them. And in fact, Taif today, everybody knows, Taif is a Muslim country or a Muslim city for, you know, over 1,000 years. And people have made great contributions to this religion from Taif. The Prophet's covenant with the people of Najran. Najran is a city near Yemen, okay, south of Mecca, and they are the Christians, it was a Christian territory, okay? So the Christians, knowing that he was calling, you know, Muhammad was saying that I'm the messenger of God, so he invited them as a delegation to meet with him, and he invited them to become Muslim. They thought about it, and the next day they came back and said, we don't want to be Muslim, but we accept your governance over us. You accept, you know, to have a Muslim government over us. Okay? So this is the covenant that he did with them. This is the contract he did with them. And he said Najran is a portion of it only. Najran and their followers have the protection of God and the protection of Muhammad, the Prophet and the Messenger of God, for themselves, their community, their land, and their goods, both those who are absent and those who are present, and for their churches and their services, meaning no bishop will be removed from his episcopate, no monk from his monastery, and no church warden from his wardenship. And for all, great or little, that is under their hand, there will be no interest, usury, and no blood revenge like they used to do in the pre-Islamic times. This was one of the conditions. Okay? This is what the Prophet ﷺ did with them. Is there Christian people who are under the umbrella of an Islamic government. And this is what he said. He protected their churches and their services and allowed them to continue to preach their religion. And he gave them security in that. A similar treaty was made by Umar ibn Khattab, the second Khalifa of the Islamic Empire, with the people of Jerusalem. A very famous treaty, in fact. Next slide, please. We look next to the successor of Muhammad, the Khalifa Abu Bakr, al-Siddiq, radiallahu anhu. Abu Bakr gave 10 directions to Yazid and Abu Sufyan. He was the commander of an army who was going out to the Levant, and he gave them directions concerning war. Okay? And I bring this because we see some un-Islamic behavior going on today, and I want to explain to you what the real Islam is and what the sources of Islam say. It says, do not kill a woman, nor a child, nor a weak old person. Don't cut down a fruit-bearing tree. Don't destroy a dwelling. Don't even kill a sheep or a camel unless you need to kill it for food. Don't set bees on fire and don't drown them. Don't misappropriate the spoils of war and don't be coward. Now you tell me, honestly, what kind of society implemented these kind of rules? Really, in war, what kind of society is implementing them? These were implemented. By God, these were implemented and historically documented to be implemented by the Muslim army. This is how they succeeded. We look at the successor of Abu Bakr, Umar ibn Khattab, very famous for his justice. They used to call him the Kingdom of Justice based on what he did. Umar saw a Jew and who was poor and his family was poor. He's a Jewish person. The Jews fought the Prophet in his time. They went back on some contract that they made. They had made agreements with the Prophet and they went back and they fought him. The Jews tried on 3 occasions to kill the Prophet. 3 well-known occasions to kill him. And here's a Jew and his family who's receiving money from the state treasury. The Muslims are paying from their pockets to suffice this person and his family. And what did Umar quote? He quoted, alms are for the poor and the needy from the Quran. This verse doesn't talk about only from the Muslims. It doesn't say, well, except for the Jews or except for the Christians. This is what alms is for, no matter who the person is we're talking about. They are for the poor and the needy. And once on a trip to Asham, Greater Syria, he encountered a group of Christian lepers and ordered that social assistance be paid to them from the again. These are not Muslim people, but why the Muslims were paying for them? They were helping them. Even the assassin, Umar ibn Khattab, was assassinated while he was praying. He was praying the early morning prayer, and he was assassinated during his prayer. SubhanAllah. By a Magian non-Muslim. And what did he do? He had every chance, laying on his deathbed with the sting of the knife still in him, to say, well, kill them all. For what they did. Because we gave them freedom in our land, look what they did to us. They killed Umar ibn Khattab. But what did he say? He specifically told his successor. He said, I advise the Khalifa who follow me to be kind to the non-Muslims and to fulfill our covenants with them, to fight for the sake of their protection, not to overburden them. This is how they were treated. This is how non-Muslims were treated in the Islamic State. When Umar radiallahu anhu, when he liberated Jerusalem from the Byzantine Romans, he agreed to conditions requested by Christian inhabitants. He allowed them to dictate certain conditions. When do conquerors allow the conquered people to make decisions concerning their future? But he did that. In fact, Omar happened to be inside one of the greatest Christian churches of Jerusalem at the time of the prayer, which is the noon prayer for Muslims. And they were going to pray in the mosque, and he says, no, we have to go outside, because if we pray here, people after us might come and say, Omar prayed here, so how can we leave it to be a church? We must make it a mosque. So I don't want them to destroy this church unjustly. So he went outside and prayed in the street. And if you go to Jerusalem today, there is the masjid of Omar ibn Khattab, and it's right next to the church. Because of this, we look at some of the examples of his justice, blind justice. We look at the Coptics, a Christian sect in Egypt that still exists today. In fact, 14 million Christians live in Egypt today. And a Coptic woman came to Omar, complaining that Amr, the governor of Egypt, that he had taken her house and destroyed it because he wanted to expand the mosque. So Omar asked Amr, what's going on here? Is this true? Yes, it's true. He said the congregation became huge and we didn't have any place to pray. And so we had to expand the mosque, and there was no direction to expand it except into her property. So we had to do it. But I offered her lots of money, and she wouldn't accept any of it. So I left the money for her in a bank account. She can take it anytime she wants. Now, if anybody knows anything about eminent domain, if you study American law and history, this concept of the American government. The government can take your house if they give you fair compensation, fair market price. If your house gets in the way of an opposed highway or a road or where they want to build a hospital or school, they can do that. They can take your house. This is called eminent domain, something which most countries have. But what does Obama do? He didn't say, oh, well, that's a good point, well, forget her. I mean, if she wants to, you know, she can get the money. We're Muslims, and, you know, who is she? You know, he says, no. He says, I'm going to go back and take part of that mosque offering, build the woman her house again. Build it back for her. This is the justice of Islam. We look at another situation with a cop, the son of Omar that we just discussed. The son was racing one day, a horse race with a Coptic Christian. And this Christian man won the race. And so the son of Omar, Abdullah, he got mad. He was irritated at this situation, and so he hit him with his whip. And so the Coptic, this isn't right, this isn't justice. So he went to the pilgrimage, during the pilgrimage, he went to talk to Omar ibn Khattab, during the pilgrimage in Mecca. In front of all the Muslims, they told Omar ibn Khattab, this is what happened, is this the way you guys behave? And he said, no. And so he brought Omar, and he brought his son, and he gave his whip, Omar's whip, to the Christian man. And he said, beat him like he beat you. Beat this Muslim. You Christian, beat this Muslim like he beat you. But this is only fair. He did it out of injustice, and so he has to. And then after that, he went and he grabbed his father and he yelled at him. And he said, when did you make the people who were born free into slaves? Again, this is not him talking about Muslim people. He's talking about Christian people, and he's giving them their rights and humiliating Muslim in the process. Because justice is justice in this religion, and it doesn't make a difference who we're talking about. The Muslim scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, very famous Muslim scholar and very prolific writer. During his age or his era, there was a huge invasion from the territories, the Mongols, people of Genghis Khan. They were invading the place of Greater Syria, which is called the Shem. And he was alive at that time. He had to. He even fought in some of the wars. And so one time he was sent as an emissary to Qaito Shah, who was the commander of the Tartar forces at the time. And he went to him to seek relief of the Muslim prisoners of war. In fact, there was to all the prisoners of war. So he went to him. The commander said, okay, you can have the Muslims. I will release them to you. So what did he say? He says, nah, that's great. Alhamdulillah, I'm gone. No. He says, no. He says, have people who are under our protection, who you've also taken as prisoners of war, non-Muslim people who are under our protection. We have committed ourselves to protecting them, and I'm not going to leave until you release them as well. And so he stayed and persisted, with having his neck cut off. He persisted until the commander allowed all the prisoners to go, Muslims and non-Muslims. Sultan Muhammad II of Fatah, the one who opened Constantinople, anyone who studied history will know, was the seat of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Roman Empire. And this was a city that has been besieged several times, but Muhammad al-Fatih, the Ottoman, Khalifa, he was the one that finally opened it for Islam, or opened it to the governorship of Islam. And so when he opened it, this is again 1453, what's interesting, we're going to see in a few slides, at this same time, exactly this same time, when basically what is now Turkey and those territories of Eastern Europe was being opened to Islam, which is Anatolia. Anatolia was being opened up to Islam. At the same time, the Muslims were being kicked out of Spain in the most humiliating, most derogatory way. So in one direction, here he comes, Muhammad al-Fatih, and what does he do? The first thing, he's well aware of what's happening to the Muslims at the hands of the Christians, and the Spanish Inquisition is just beginning. And what does he do? He proclaims himself the protector of the Greek church. In fact, all historians have agreed that had Muhammad al-Fatih not proclaimed himself the protector of the Greek church, there would be no Greek church today. If he would have destroyed it, there would be no such thing as a Greek Orthodox church. And this is what he did. Persecution of the Christians was forbidden, and a decree was issued securing for the newly elected patriarch Gennadios and his bishops and successors after him all privileges previously enjoyed under the former non-Muslim rule. In fact, he was also given the power, the patriarch was given the power to bring to the Sultan's direct attention any unjust practices by the government. We look at today at the churches of the Middle East. Right now, today, you get on a plane tomorrow and you fly to Syria, you fly to Egypt, you fly to Jordan, you fly to Turkey, you fly to Morocco, any of these Muslim countries. You're going to see that all of these churches are in existence still today. There's still many Christians, and in fact, if anybody recollects the unfortunate incident a few months ago where there was some bombings in Morocco that killed a lot of Jews. Okay, did anyone happen to wonder? Jews, Morocco, Muslim country, Morocco, been living there for a long time. Okay, these Jews have been living there since they were kicked out of Spain by the Christians. The Jews were protected under the Muslims in Spain, and I'm sorry, in Morocco, and still protected now. So you're going to see, and you can all read this, basically, the crosses are all still there, the churches are all still there. In fact, one of the Arabic historians, Al-Tirmidhi, he says that it is agreed by all historians that all churches in Qaira were established after the coming of Islam. And again, this is not a secular secular government, like the governments of today. They don't really care what you do, as long as you follow their parliamentary orders. They don't care what you want to be. We're talking about a religious rule, a theocracy here. And if you look at any theocracy, this is something very odd to see. That the theocracy that allows competition, or allows other practices of religion in its own society. Now, to be honest, in the Islamic texts all say that you cannot, it is forbidden for any Christian or Jew to build a church or a synagogue in the Muslim state. It is forbidden. They can have ones that they have. They can rebuild the ones, renovate the ones that they have, but they should not be allowed to rebuild, to build new ones. But this is what happened. It wasn't like the opposite, like what you see today. That there is something in the law books that people are denying it from you. In fact, in Islam, it's something on the law books, but they were tolerant in it. They allowed people to, they said, okay, well, the nation is growing. We'll allow them to have a church. We'll allow them to do this. We'll allow them to do that. Next slide. Looking, even the government offices, okay? The offices in Islamic states were always given to those best qualified, regardless of their background. And there's numerous examples. We see some here from the Umayyads and the Abbasid Khalifa. They had many people come and who were Christian and Jewish, and they were part of the government. Next slide. Even fields of science. I mean, the fields of science were under Muslim rule. And all these people are listed here right now. Hunayn, Hibatullah, Huna, Thabit ibn Qurrah, all these people are non-Muslim. And with the exception of the last one who accepted Islam after studying with a Muslim. But all these people were non-Muslims who were allowed, in fact, to become leaders in their field in the Muslim territory. Next slide. We look from the book of Will Durant, The Story of Civilization, and I quote a couple of slides I'm going to quote to you. So these Zimmi, basically the people, Zimmi or Zimma are people who are under covenant or under the protection of the Muslim state, okay? So to these Zimmi, the Christians, the Zoroastrians, the Sabians, and the Jews, the Umayyad Khalifa offered a degree of toleration hardly equaled in contemporary Christian lands. They were allowed the free practice of their faith and the retention of their churches on condition that they wear a distinctive honey-colored dress and pay a poll tax of from 1 to 4 dinars per year according to their income. Just for information, 1 to 4 dinars in today's, you know, monetary, 1 dinar might equal in the neighborhood of $100. Okay, so we're talking about $100 to $400 of taxes per year. So we all wish we could pay that. Next slide. And he says, this tax fell only upon non-Muslims capable of military service. It was not levied upon the monks, women, adolescents, slaves, the old, the crippled, the blind, or the very poor. And all these people were free from not paying it. In return, the Zimmi were excused or excluded from military service and from the 2.5% Muslim tax for community charity, and they received the protection of the government. Next slide. Their testimony was not admitted in Muslim courts, but a very unique aspect of the Muslim rule is that they were allowed to have self-rule in their territory. They were allowed to have their own leaders and judges and laws. And so if a Christian had a problem, he didn't have to go to the Muslim court. He could go to a Christian court and have the judgment of the Christian court on him. He could be married by a priest. A Jew could be married by a rabbi. He didn't have to be going to be married by a Muslim. This is exactly what he's trying to say here. The Christian heretics, this gave them huge fields because they were being persecuted, being killed by the thousands in the Roman Empire. And so where did they go? They went to the Muslim land. And so they were now free and safe under Muslim rule. The founder was unintelligible. In the 9th century, the Muslim governor of Antioch appointed a special guard to keep Christian sects from massacring one another at church, in fact. So even again, they're protecting the Christians. I mean, a lot of places, I mean, even now, I mean, you see that if there's, you know, your enemy is killing you themselves, okay, most people would say, well, praise God and say, I hope more happens. You know, they're not going to say, no, we can't let this happen, we have to stop. And so what did they do? They went and they stopped the Christians from slaughtering themselves. Monasteries and nunneries compressed under the ruling of the Umayyad Khalifa. And it says for a time the relations between the two religions were so good and genial that the Christians wearing crosses were talking in mosques with Muslim friends. And the Muslim bureaucracy had hundreds of Christian employees, and Christians rose frequently to high offices as to provoke Muslim complaints. In fact, he talks here about Sergius, father of St. John of Damascus, who was chief finance minister to Abdelmelek Ibn Marwan. And John himself, the last of the Greek fathers of the church, headed the council that governed Damascus. Okay? This is how they went to the Muslim, in the Muslim state. Now, this is the information of a Christian here who's writing this book, and he's being objective, he's reporting history as it happened. So he says, despite or because of the policy of tolerance in early Islam, the new faith won over to itself in time most of the Christians, nearly all the Zoroastrians and the pagans, and many of the Jews of Asia, Egypt, and North Africa. And this is the reference for you if you'd like to learn more. Now we'll talk, I'm going to take a little drink here, but we'll talk about the truth regarding the spread of Islam. At this point in time, am I going too fast or confusing anybody? So we look at the spread of Islam. Okay, most people, again, they'll tell you, and we're going to get to that. Of course, most of the Western books will say Islam was spread by the sword, that had these pictures of these long-bearded, you know, bloodthirsty Muslims running around, swords drawn, holding their swords to people's necks, saying, you know, accept Islam or die. It's just a true picture. It's just how Islam spread. But Islam in the 10th century was the main religion, or at least the religion of the majority of the people in an area covering more than half of the civilized world, half of the civilized world in the 10th century, and that's only 300 years from the time of the Prophet Muhammad. 300 years, Islam spread from Mecca and Medina to half of the world. It stretched over three continents, from Spain in the west and North Europe to the farthest end of Asia, up to China and New Guinea in the east, from Morocco and North Africa to the southern tip of Africa, covering two-thirds of the African continent. And by this time, people had not discovered Australia or the western hemisphere of America. And so how much Islam dominated at that time? This is what it says. It's one of the most striking facts of human history, that this spread took place in 3 centuries only. 3 centuries, this is how far Islam went. And again, I want to remind you, let there be no compulsion in religion, as the word of the Quran teaches. And even it says in Surah Al-Kahf, in the 18th chapter, say, the truth is from your Lord, so let him who will believe, let him will accept it. And so you cannot force a conversion in Islam. And so this is something that all the Muslims understood. In fact, those early generations are our example. And so they had the best thing of their, and they definitely understood this. So how did it happen? Next slide. Most of the Western writers, especially under the influence of the church, have never failed to accuse Islam of spreading by force of the sword. The causes of this prejudice lie mainly in the fact that the spread of Islam has often occurred at the expense of Christianity. Most of these people who were accepting Islam were actually leaving Christianity to become Muslim. So, of course, there's going to be a little bit of pain there. While Islam has for centuries obtained numerous conversions from Christianity without much effort or organized missionary activity, Christianity has almost never been able to achieve conversions from Islam in spite of sophisticated means and well-organized missionary activity. So this is not my words. This is the words of John Cogley, who was the author of the book Religion of the Secular Age. He's not a Muslim, and he's just kind of reporting what he sees. This has caused his missionaries and most of the Orientalists to develop a complex within themselves by depicting Islam and introducing it as a regressive, vulgar religion of savage people, which continues still today. Most Americans, even educated people in this country, if you ask them about Islam, we're going to give you this kind of description. They're going to think that the Muslims are a backward people, an uncivilized people, and uneducated people, and so this still persists. Another non-Muslim, Delacy O'Leary, states in his book, Islam at the Crossroads, history makes it clear, however, that the legend of fanatical Muslims sweeping through the world and forcing Islam as the point of sword upon conquered races is one of the most fantastically absurd myths that historians have ever repeated. Next slide. Another interesting Christian observation comes from Mr. Bale in his dictionary under the article of Muhammad. And he says, the Christians have not been given orders to do anything but preach and instruct. And this is exactly true. I mean, Christians are not given orders to kill people or to, you know, defend others, you know, through violence or anything like that. They were told to go out and teach this religion, and that's it, nothing more. They were not given the law concerning secular practice. And so he says, yet, despite this, from time immemorial, they have been exterminating by fire and sword all those who are not of their religion. We may feel certain that if Western Christians, instead of the Saracens, which means Muslims, one of the derogatory terms actually against Muslims, and the Turks, had won the dominion over Asia, there would be today not a trace left of the Greek church, as I mentioned earlier, and they would never have tolerated Islam as the infidels have tolerated Christianity there. And again, infidels here, he's trying to say Islam. So he says, we Christians enjoy the fine advantage of being far better versed than others in the art of killing, bombarding, and exterminating the human race. And this is, again, just his observation. How then did Islam spread so rapidly? Many have thought to try and answer this question. Millions of people are accepting Islam, you know, over, you know, 200 years. And very few of these people are actually going back. It's not like you can say, well, they were forced, and then after, you know, things slackened up a little bit, you know, they went back to their old belief. It doesn't happen. And these are still practicing people still today. I mean, practicing families. He mentions here, why do 1,000 Christians become Muslims? Even that is probably an outdated statistic to one Muslim who adopts Christianity. Most people would say it's probably closer to, you know, 10 to 50,000 Christians that accept this time versus one who accepts Christianity in that regard, even till today. And so, again, this is some people try to give the argument of the sword. Thomas Carlyle, one of the famous historians, gave a nice reply about this. He said, first of all, he said, if you're going to say that these people went out and conquered these territories by forcing Islam with the sword, he says, you have to understand someone got started this religion. Muhammad has to be standing there, so I send him, you know, starting this religion. So he didn't go out by himself, you know, with a sword and grab all these companions of his and force them under the sword, okay? So, number one, these people had to accept Islam initially, you know, for it to have started, okay? They had to really accept it. And secondly, they had to accept it enough that they're willing to die for it, okay? Thousands upon millions of people are willing to die for this religion and continue to do so today. So how can you say that a sword does that? A sword will, you know, will scare you. It might make you do something temporarily, but you're not going to have your heart will not be in it. You're not going to go out and so why are these people fighting for this religion? Next slide. Others allege that low morality. Some people are going to say, well, you know, these poor Bedouin Arabs, you know, they're out there in the middle of the desert with nothing, and here's the Quran coming and promising them gardens of you know, beautiful women and, you know, sensual pleasures and nice food and nice drink and relaxation. So these guys, boy, they haven't seen nothing of that, and they're out in the middle of the desert. They don't even get a drink of water, so they're ready to, you know, jump in and dive and die for it. I mean, what kind of fool would accept this kind of understanding? You know, what kind of person is going to go, even in this situation today, is going to go out and kill himself for a promise if he doesn't believe in it? In all these explanations, he states the religion itself is left out of the question. Everybody wants to say something, but nobody wants to say what it is. What it is the religion itself. Accept this religion, what it contains. Islam itself was the main cause for its triumph. Islam not only was at once accepted by many peoples and races in Arabia, Syria, Persia, Egypt, North Africa, Spain, at its first outbreak, but he says, with the exception of Spain, it has never lost its vantage ground. It has never, you know, people never turned back. And the reason why people turned back in Spain is because of the Spanish Inquisition, which we'll get to, because nobody could have held on in that situation. So he says, and this is Stanley Lane Poole, by the way, that I'm quoting from, he says, admitting the mixed causes that contributed to the rapidity of the first spread of Islam, they do not account for the duration of Islam. Okay, maybe swords can make someone convert again temporarily, but you can't give endurance through something like this. Promises, you know, false promises, threats are not going to give you permanence. And this is what this religion has. So there must be something in the religion itself to explain its persistence and spread and to account for its present hold over so large a population of the dwellers of the earth. And so he states the conclusion, Islam has stirred an enthusiasm that has never been surpassed. Islam has had its martyrs, its self-tormentors, its those who have renounced all that life offered and have accepted death with a smile for the sake of the faith that was in them. And this is a true and adequate description of the religion. Now, the point that I wanted to add was, okay, say that Islam was spread by the sword. Okay, let's allege that. Let's hypothetically say, okay, let's say these people actually, you know, these poor Bedouins, they just wanted a nice girl and some, you know, some nice drinks, and they wanted to go to the paradise. Let's allege all that. Right now, why are people still accepting Islam? Here's it. Professor David Barrett, he's actually from the National Institute of the Revival of the Priesthood. He's a Catholic priest. He states, quoting from the school table on global missions, he says, Islam is the fastest growing major religion today with a fivefold increase from a population of 200 million in the year 1900. 200 million people in the year 100 years ago to today, over 1.3 billion people. So Islam has increased by 1 billion people in 100 years. Where are the stories? I mean, I haven't seen it on CNN or BBC. If you guys are seeing it, let me know. Because I haven't seen anyone going out there and you know, torturing people. And now, if you go to Saudi Arabia, if you go to the United Arab Emirates, these places that were deserts 50 years ago, now they're some of the most beautiful places on this earth. So what happened to the women and the nice food in Jannah, in paradise? People are still accepting Islam, a huge number today. And this is what he's talking about. He says, we got to do something here as Catholics because, you know, pretty soon here, the year 2025, 1.8 billion Muslims are going to be living in a world with 1.3 billion Catholics. And in fact, religion of Islam, the most up-to-date statistics, this was written in the year 2000, I think, the most up-to-date statistics say that Islam now is close to 1.5 billion people. And so, I mean, it's growing at an enormous rate even till today. And so Joseph Goodell from the Christian Research Institute also is having a problem with this, you know, with this issue. He says, is Islam the fastest growing religion in the world? Is it the fastest growing religion in America? He said, the demographics tell us that the answer is yes to both questions. Undoubtedly, he's actually got a very thorough paper that he's written available on the internet. Very, very thorough. Multiple references, multiple statistical references. He says, Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world that has seen Operation World, written by Johnstone. He says, for example, in Europe, according to UN statistics, between the 9 years of 1989 to 1998, 9 years, he said, Islam increased in Europe 100%. In fact, one of the most amazing statistics I saw, he said that in Brussels, Belgium, that 57% of the children born in the hospital were Muslim. In Brussels, Belgium, not in Saudi Arabia, not in Indonesia, in Belgium, in the middle of Europe. He says, civic figures may be debated, but what cannot be debated is the phenomenal growth of Islam. It is, according to U.S. statistics, the Muslim population in the U.S. grew by 25% in that same period of time. Those 9 years. Since 1990, in the past, you know, what, 13 years now? He says the registered Islamic centers and mosques in the United States has tripled to over 2,500 registered centers now. Now, some people want to say, oh, that's because Muslims have a lot of kids. That's why. Every one of those women, they got like 10 kids or 12 kids, and that's why it is, you know, it's just because the Europeans only have one child, or some of them decide not to have children, right? Or the Christians or the Jews. Is that really the case? That's not going to explain why there's 45% of the Muslims in the United States are African American. These are people who are the children of Christian slaves, okay, who actually had their religion forced upon them by the sword or by death. A lot of them were Muslim. A lot of them were taken out of Africa as Muslims and forced to become Christians. A lot of them are reverting back to Islam. 45%, and he says, and this is like almost 3 million people. I think that's actually an accurate statistic. I mean, I think he's underquoting it, but talking about almost 3 million people in this country who are African American have accepted Islam. They didn't come as Muslims. They didn't grow up in this country as Muslims. And we're not talking about the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam under these statistics because it's not considered a branch of Islam. So please don't confuse them. So where are these people coming from? Another statistic that I didn't have a chance to write in. 7,000 women in the United States are accepting Islam every single year. 7,000 women. That's more than 12 a day. 12 women in this country are accepting Islam. Islam is such an oppressive religion to women, right? Why is 12 women per day accepting this religion? In Europe, they say, in Britain, the most, and this is something coming out of one of the British newspapers, not a Muslim publication, says 4-1, the ratio of women accepting Islam, women to men, 4-1 accepting Islam in Britain. We look at the jizya now. I want to talk about the jizya. We mentioned that a little bit earlier, which is the poll tax, okay? The poll tax which people living in the Islamic State are required to pay. A lot of people said, oh, you know, that's why people accepted Islam, because they didn't want to pay the jizya. They you know, that was such an oppressive tax, you know, the $400 for the rich people. Let's learn a little about the jizya. The Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he appointed Abdullah from over the jizya of the people of Zimna. And when he was leaving, when Abdullah was leaving, the Prophet called him back and said to him, listen, surely whoever oppresses a mu'ahid, someone who's under our contract, under our protection, one of the people of Zimna, whoever oppresses this person who's living under our protection, or imposes upon him more than he can afford, and humiliates him, or takes anything from him without his consent, I personally will challenge him on the Day of Judgment. The Prophet come as the opponent of this person on the Day of Judgment. In another hadith, or a statement of the Prophet, the Prophet said that the person who kills the mu'ahid, the person who the Muslim who kills one of these people under the protection of the Islamic State, will not smell the fragrance of paradise. I mean, he's going to be far from paradise. He's going to be in another place. And he said, even though the fragrance of paradise can be smelled at the distance of 40 years. So this is the kind of protection the Prophet ensured for the people of Allah, or the people of Islam. So what is responsible as the Muslims? Again, from the work of Al-Qarafi, he says we have to care for feed the hungry, provide clothes, address them politely, and even tolerate their harm, even if it was from a neighbor, even though Muslims would have an upper hand. Must also be advised, the people must also be advised sincerely on their affairs, and protected against anyone who tries to hurt them or their family, anyone who tries to steal their wealth, by anyone who tries to violate their rights. This is the obligation of the Muslim people. Next slide. Umar ibn al-Khattab, which you mentioned earlier, he once saw an old Jewish beggar and he ordered that he be paid a salary. He's a different Jew from the other gave. And he said, just for us to take from him the jizya when he's young and forget him when he's old, or abandon him when he's old, that's not justice. He paid it when he's young, so we should pay him now. Social security, which for most of us young people may not exist because we're going to be older, this is a big problem. But this is the social security of the Islamic State. Ali ibn Abi Talib, the fourth Khalifa, the fourth successor of the Prophet, stated, they pay the jizya. Properties can be considered sacred like ours. There is no difference between their lives and their property from our property and our lives when they pay the jizya. Okay, they have a responsibility. We have rights on them when they do this. And even if, you know, the jizya, the main point of the jizya was so that the Muslims would protect them, because Christians and the Jews and the non-Muslims in the society were not allowed to fight. They were not put in the army. Because again, if you have a person who's Christian, why is he going to go fight for the religion of Islam? It doesn't make any sense. He's not believing it, so he's not going to be really out there, wanting to give success to the religion. So that's why they were taken out of the army. But in certain cases, historically, certain Christian groups did fight. And these did not have the jizya put on them. They were allowed to fight with the Muslims, and in fact, they were even allowed to share in the spoils of what? A very nice story from concerning the jizya. This comes from the time of Umar ibn Khattab, and this comes under the story of one of the companions of the Prophet, Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah, who was the commander of all the forces of Greater Syria at that time. And he said, again, you know, we're supposed to protect them, okay? So all these Christians who were living in Greater Syria, they were obligated protection by the Muslim forces, okay? So Heraclius, who was the emperor, the Byzantine Roman emperor, he said, I'm going to finish these Muslims now. So he got a huge army, to face them. And so Abu Ubaidah, as the commander, he said, we're going to have to deploy. We have to take all the people out of these cities, and we have to send them to the line. We have to send them to the front line. So we will be able to, repel this attack by Heraclius. And so what did they do? They've been taking the jizya from these Christians for a long time. And so they went to them and gave them a speech. He said, we are returning your money to you. You're returning the jizya money to the people. So you're giving back their taxes. He says, we're returning your money to you because we know the enemy has gathered troops. By the terms stipulated in the contract, you have obliged us to protect you. However, since we now need to deploy forces to meet the Byzantines, we are unable to fulfill these conditions, and we will return to you what you paid to us. We will, though, abide the terms in the contract if God assists us throughout the enemy. If God assists us and we defeat them, we'll come back and think everything will be like it was before. These people are shocked. These people are living under the tyranny of the Roman Empire, where if it was the Romans, they would have kept what they took and took what they didn't have. You know, they would take the rest from the people. They wouldn't give anything back to them. They would say, we need everything now, so give us everything that you have. Okay? But these Muslims paid it back to them, so they were like, what are you doing? This is something we've never seen before. You know, because what's driving these Muslims, what should be driving every Muslim, is that you're going to meet God on the Day of Judgment, and you're going to be responsible, and you're going to be accountable for what you did. If you make a contract, you better uphold that contract, or you'll have to answer to God on the Day of Judgment. So we're not concerned about this person or that group, or this idea, or what this person has to say. We're concerned about our relationship with God, and fulfilling our duty to that. And that's why these Muslims did. That's why those people who were trained by the Prophet ﷺ and had this kind of character, this is why they behaved the way they did. It wasn't the people of Hemsay, the city in Syria, which he was talking to. He said, we like your rule and justice far better than the state of oppression and tyranny in which we were under the Christian Byzantines. The army of Heraclius, we shall need with your help repulse from the city. He said, not only are we going to, we wish you well, but we're going to help you too. We're going to fight with you because we have to them. We must too. And the same thing happened in all the other cities that were inhabited by Christians and Jews. To the extent that after the Muslims did defeat Heraclius, the gates of all these cities were open and the people went out, the Christians and Jews went out celebrating that the Muslims had defeated the Byzantine Roman Empire, the Christian Byzantine Roman Empire as well. So in the last section, I hope I haven't bored you to so far or overwhelmed you with all this information, but the last thing I want to talk about, now that we've talked about how Islam treated the people, historically, how it should treat people, protection. Let's look at how the Muslims were treated by others. We start with the state. November 1095, Pope Urban II initiates the first European attempt, of which there were left after, at colonizing the Muslim world. It is known as the Crusade. And this is the quote that is taken from one of the books of, I believe, Craig. I haven't cited, but concerning the eyewitness account from the Crusade. He said, for you must hasten to carry aid to your brethren dwelling in the East, who need
Okay, guys, he got disconnected. Okay, let's see if he calls back.